Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Rising, because he was terrible.
At least employer.
Thing where the team caps got the cap.
That was
pulled in Flushing, New York. Doing what they didn't. Able to. Thank you, Pete. Welcome back, Grant and Danny, 106.7 The Fan. Will there be a college football season? Will it take place in the fall or the spring? We've been asking those questions for weeks, and the trend today is that there might be one, but it's going to have to wait until the spring. Let's get some more information from Aaron Murray, who played quarterback at Georgia from 2010 to 2013, over 13,000 passing yards and 121 touchdowns, and you can hear him on SiriusXM's SEC Radio and ESPNU Radio as an analyst now. Aaron, we're Grant and Danny in D.C. Thanks for the time. How are you?
Hey, doing good. Well, I was doing a lot better this morning before, obviously, the news that just broke, I think, within the past hour. But I think after yesterday's meetings with all the presidents and ADs, I think we were kind of expecting something early this week. And unfortunate that hopefully this isn't a domino effect from here.
That's what it looks like could happen. So I guess let's just start there with you. Do you think there's still a chance? You see Trevor Lawrence, Jim Harbaugh, a lot of the big names in college football advocating to play, that some conferences or schools do play in the fall, or do you think it's going to be uniform and everyone has to move to the spring?
It's going to be interesting. I know, you know, ACC and SEC, just being down here in the South, feel like they want to give it a go, talking with people, and they want to see what it looks like when kids are back on campus and if they're able to keep everything under control when it comes to keeping the players safe, keeping the rest of the student body safe, coaches, teachers, all that. It doesn't help that the decision was made right now on August 10th for the Big Ten. I still think it's a little bit premature in my mind. I just don't see. I know, listen, it's crazy times. This pandemic has been absolutely terrible for everyone around the world. I just don't see much has changed in the past week that you had to make a decision right now. I still think that there's a few weeks to go before maybe you had to say, okay, we're going to cancel, we're going to try to move it to the spring, or we're going to go forward and see if we can play as many games as we can. So I think the SEC, at least starting in late September, gives a little bit more room to let things the situation unfold itself a little bit more before they kind of cancel the season. So I think these conferences, like I said, SEC, ACC, the Big 12, I think those three are going to wait this thing out as long as they can to see if we can play football. I do expect the Pac-12 to make the decision soon and kind of follow suit with the Big 10 with canceling their season most likely this week. But those other three big boys, I think they're going to try to give it a go. My only concern is how can we make sure that these players are smart, and that's going to be the issue. I mean, we're talking about 18 to 22-year-old kids that as soon as you get the co-eds on campus in a few weeks, can you tell those kids, hey, you need to stay in your dorm, you need to go eat, you need to go to practice, and you go to bed. It just takes a few, as we've seen, that you get a few kids that go rogue pretty much, and then all of a sudden you have an entire team that has come down with COVID. So, but going back to your question, I do think the SEC, ACC, and the Big 12 will at least try to make this thing happen and see if we can get a season going.
Aaron Murray with us here on Grant and Danny. Aaron, first a compliment and then a question. Just in 2010, I remember a Georgia team that you guys struggled a little bit, and you went back and forth with Auburn, who was on their way to a national title. I remember you getting hit about 7,000 times in that game, and you kept getting up, and it was a really, really impressive performance. And I never forgot that, and I've always been a fan of yours since then. And I want to go back to the time when you were a student. How would you have felt right now? Would you have wanted to push to the spring? Would you have wanted to kind of push ahead? And maybe how might your opinion be changed from then to now?
I would have loved to push ahead. You know, I thought Jim Harbaugh made it great. I just was reading an article on him, and he came out with a statement. I mean, they've done a tremendous job at the University of Michigan, along with a lot of other schools. I mean, he said, this is not easy. I mean, this is difficult, but we're doing a great job making sure our guys are staying away from the craziness going on in the world. They're focusing on football, and all the tests we've had, we've done a great job keeping those numbers really down. Like you said, it's going to be hard. This isn't going to be easy. This is a new norm going on right now. But it doesn't mean we can't play football. And you're seeing a lot of players right now, too, across the nation. I mean, Trevor Lawrence, another great example. They want to play. I mean, is the situation worse for these kids on campus compared to being at home? And I know there's a lot of liability, and the presidents and ADs are looking out for the universities and making sure that they don't have a bunch of lawsuits coming their way at the end of this whole thing. But I think the players see this, hey, we want to play. We feel safe in our facilities. We feel safe on campus. I would, as a player, if I was in this situation, I would want to play. Me being 29 years old, looking at it right now, I still would want to play. And I still think, you can play. Like I said, it's going to be difficult, but day-to-day life for everyone across this country right now is difficult. I have an 8-week-year-old baby right now, you know, so the decisions my wife and I make every single day about, you know, what can we do? What can't we do? What family members can we allow to see our child? I mean, these are difficult decisions that we're having to make sure that we stay safe and that our child stays safe. It's the same decision that these universities are going to have to make too. And obviously the Big Ten thought it's safe. It's not safe enough to allow these guys to play. I think that you could find a way to make it happen. And like I said, as a player, I would want to play as well.
Congrats on becoming a dad. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, very cool, man.
Yeah, thank you. It's been fun. It's interesting now because we can't really do much. So it's been good just to be able to focus on him and just kind of grind away. So I'm hoping that I get to call some games this fall and get on the road a little bit and do my thing with CBS. But if not, it'll be a daddy daycare for the fall, trying to you know, get his sleeping pattern put together.
Aaron Murray completed 921 passes in 4 years in the SEC at Georgia. I mentioned 121 touchdowns, a 158 rating, and a really successful career with the Bulldogs. Let's say what your thinking slash hoping happens does, and the SEC and the ACC, you know, maybe you throw in another conference or two, plays. What would that look like, do you think? Kind of spitball with me then. Does that mean they play their conference schedules, and then on the back end there's a playoff with the best teams and a championship for, you know, your fall champion, and then we do it again in the spring with those conferences? How would that all work out, do you think?
I think if there are conferences that go ahead and play the season, and I mean, even if they get through half a season, the 3/4 of a season, I don't think you can then the rest of the conferences, especially the Power Five, you know, say the Pac-12, if they do end up canceling their season, and the Big Ten try to play a season in the spring. I just don't think that would make sense. Especially if you had to then turn around and then play a regular season next fall against teams that would then at that point have 7 months off to recover and get ready for a season. I just don't think it'd be safe and the best thing for those players and coaches. So I think for them, they are hoping if they cancel that the rest of the conference is canceled, then you move forward with the spring season. But if the SEC goes ahead, the ACC goes ahead, and the Big 12 goes ahead, I don't know if you could do a playoff. Obviously, you could make that happen if you definitely wanted to. I think you just may say, hey, listen, we're going to try to play a season. We're going to try to get to a conference championship game. We're going to have a conference championship, and then that winner wins the SEC. And honestly, at that point, I think that would be a successful 2020 season, and you call it quits from there. Let's regroup and try to figure out how we can have spring football when it comes to just normal spring practice and then get ready for a fall season in 2021. So, like I said, you could make it happen with the playoffs. I just don't know if you would – I don't know if you'd want to push it that far. I think if you – like I said, you could call it quits, and I think it'd be a super successful season if you could make it 10 games plus an SEC championship game or 11 games plus an ACC championship game at the end of the day.
If everybody had to do the spring, I think you touched on some of the logistical problems if some do and some don't, but if everybody had to do the spring, how manageable would it be and what would be the biggest obstacles to then get back on a regular calendar moving forward?
I think the biggest obstacles is if I'm an NFL draft prospect, if I'm Trevor Lawrence, if I'm Justin Fields, if I'm a potential top three round, especially first rounder, I'm not playing. You know, I'm sorry, but I'm not. Especially those guys who have accomplished so much already in their career. I mean, you're talking about potentially getting hurt and losing millions of dollars, and possibly having to stay and play another season. And then say if you do get hurt in the spring, would you even then be ready to play in the fall? So then all of a sudden you miss another season and then miss that opportunity to then get ready to help your draft stock come that following spring for the 2022 NFL draft. So I think you would lose a lot of really good players. And then obviously the fact that playing two seasons in one calendar year, it would be extremely difficult. I mean, you go back to what you talked about with me, my freshman year playing against Auburn. I mean, if you had to tell me I had to go through an entire SEC schedule, get the crap knocked out of me week in and week out for about 3-4 months, and then get a month and a half, 2 month break, and then have to go do it all again, I don't know physically if I would be able to do that. I mean, it's a grueling schedule, especially when you play in some of these conferences, these Power Five conferences. To ask these kids to be able to do it again in a short amount of time, I don't know. So then at that point, do you talk about, okay, do we have a shortened season both seasons? You know, do we play 8-10 games in the spring, 8-10 games in the fall? There's so many scenarios that would have to play out. I don't think it would be safe for the players. I mean, it would be cool to have a spring. I think if you want to say we can't have football in the fall, I would be for trying to make it happen and have some abbreviated schedule in the spring. I just know as a player, to ask me to have to go play 24 games in an amount of 7 months, because that was what it would be. You'd play a 12-game season plus a potential SEC, ACC championship game plus a bowl game or a national championship game and then a playoff. So maybe 15 games and then have to turn around and do it all over again 2 months later. I just don't think these kids would be capable and their bodies could hold up enough to be able to do that.
Yeah, Aaron, I'm with you. I think it's a non-starter if you play in the spring that you could then start the season at the normal fall spot that you would in 2021. Still,
yeah,
so
I think
much
you could abbreviate the schedules, though. You could abbreviate the schedules. I mean, if you want to say, okay, we're going to play in the spring and we still want to make the fall happen, maybe you just we're going to shorten both seasons and make them only conference games and say we're going to play a 8-10-game season only conference, and then we're going to play another 8-10-game season only conference. That's why it's less time, it's less game, it's less banging on the body. But I do think you run into the issue of losing your best players that have a potential to be drafted. Because like I said, if I was a first-round draft pick and I have a potential to be a top-five pick like some of these top quarterbacks, I don't think I would risk it by playing in a spring season. I think that's why you're seeing these guys saying, hey, we want to play. We want one more season. We want to go right now. We don't want to wait to the spring, because if we do, there's a chance most likely we're not going to play.
Yeah, appreciate the time and the insight. It's smart, and it's good takes from a guy who's going to be talking about whatever action comes down the pike on ESPNU on SiriusXM, Aaron Murray. Aaron, thank you, man. We appreciate you.
Thanks, Aaron.
I appreciate it, guys. Stay safe.
And the bottom line is, Danny, he mentioned it. We talked about it with Trevor Lawrence. Of course, those guys want to play. They should want to play, but they don't get paid. And so how do you advocate on their behalf when they're going out there at the risk of getting sick and not really getting much for it? I mean, they're going to get room and board. They're going to get their scholarship one way or the other, so you can't say they have to play to earn that necessarily. That's the problem you have to come back to. Bottom of the hour in 15 minutes, the reporter with the Washington Post covering the court system who's got the details on the Darius Geis allegations. He's going to join us to tell us what he's found in some of those court documents that they have unearthed. You're listening to G&D on the Fan. Washington Post covering the court system who's got Grant and Danny on 106.7 The Fan. Thanks much, as always, for listening to the show. Welcome back. So much to cover today. You know, occasionally, during this pandemic with 4 hours, you felt like we had enough content for, I don't know, like a segment or two, and the rest of the time we were filling some things. Today's been very different, though. We could probably do a 7 or 8 hour show if we had the gas in the tank with all of the things to discuss. So we'll have to keep peeling layers through the next couple of days on some of these things. But among them, you've got what's going on with Darius Geis. And at the bottom of the hour, coming up in 10 minutes, we'll talk to the court reporter for the Washington Post. who's got some details, and they are troubling, on the allegations and the accusations against Geis in the domestic violence case that Washington decided to wash their hands of when they released him as soon as he got arrested. But Ron Rivera talked about that today. He met with reporters for the first time since releasing Geis this morning before he was asked a single question about it. He offered this opening statement.
Just want to open this up by saying, you know, on Friday I made a decision that I believe was in the best interest of this organization, our players, and our fans going forward. Very difficult decision. You know, anytime you have to release a very talented young football player, it's always a tough decision. But this type of circumstances, this type of situation, we take those allegations very, very seriously. And, you know, we had to make a decision going forward. And sometimes it's one of these things that there are processes, there are situations, there are circumstances that you go through. Each situation, each circumstance is unique. Each one will be handled and dealt with differently to what we believe is best for the organization going forward. And that's probably the most important thing. I talked to the players yesterday, basically told them that that I had made a decision that I believe was in the best interest of our organization. And if it was the right decision, we will benefit from it. And if it's not, it will be on me. I will take full responsibility as we go forward to try and make sure we do things the right way. And we'll go from there.
I like that Rivera basically wore this one way or the other. He said, look, if this ends up being wrong, and I think he's just leaving open the possibility, an exoneration, you know, it comes out that the accusations don't end up either holding up, or Geis gets out of this, ends up being signed somewhere and playing in a couple of months, and he's great, and he talks about how, you know, Washington should have stood by him and they didn't. He says, if someone looks bad, make it be me. This is my call. It's my decision. I think right now this football team needs to not have this guy on it. And I really liked the way he handled that today.
Same here. And this is all I've ever wanted. I mean, again, it, someone that came in with credibility in Mike Shanahan, who could have chosen a number of organizations and was given huge amounts of power, somehow never was responsible for any decisions. And if you ask him, it was always somebody else that was imposing these things on him. I like that Ron Rivera is standing here saying, I made this call, right, wrong, or indifferent. If it turns out that I'm wrong, let me know about it, and we'll respond accordingly. I like that an awful lot. This isn't the Bruce Allen era of hiding behind things, or, you know, only wanting to seek credit, or when the Reuben Foster thing works out, and he was quote unquote the mastermind behind a waiver claim. I'm sure it takes a mastermind to do that, you know. But I liked it an awful lot, and Rivera's action, swift, whether I agree or not. I like the accountability that's at least an attempt at such, something that this organization has been lacking for decades.
I don't blame him for not delving deep into the specifics of the release.
Sure.
And he's a pro, and he's not going to give you a lot of meat on these bones. I mean, Jay Gruden at times was honest to a fault, as we saw. That's just not going to be Ron Rivera's way. He's been around this block too long. But he was asked about the timeline. He didn't want to go into it. It's very important to try to find out what they knew when they released him, when they knew it, how long they've known about the Geis issues, but he just didn't want to shed any insight on that.
Sam, I really want to get into that, just the fact that the statement that we put out really details what we did for the most part. And so, you know, I don't want to get back into a situation, circumstances. And I said, though, each situation is unique, and each situation will be dealt that way as we go forward.
Now, it also came up, and something that hasn't been commented on, was that Darius Geis may have actually hurt his knee in practice on the last day he was with the team before these allegations came out. That would have been on, I guess, Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
That he had some type of knee injury. And for all we know, I mean, he could have just had some discomfort and tweaked it and gone off to the side for a couple of minutes. There's not really any insight on that. It's not something Rivera has gotten into, but Ian Rappaport of NFL Network mentioned that. Mm-hmm. And you hear Rivera talking about case by case. Every situation's going to be different. This is a guy who has played in 5 games in 2 years, who's never available because of health, in a very crowded running back room, which he talked about all the guys that they like. I mean, he went all the way down the depth chart to Ronald Barber, pointing out how much they think, you know, he can help, and he may not even be here. He's probably still the fifth guy in the mix at this moment. They like their running backs, with or without Geis, who is probably the most talented, part of why they felt like they could move on from him as quickly as they did, I'm sure.
And it's why, unpopularly, before all this, I mean, I had no idea anything that was going on in this regard, but it's why I wasn't doing anything in the Darius Geis, game. I basically said, hey, I want to see Antonio Gibson, Bryce Love, and everybody else. I wasn't counting on guys for anything. Any production he was going to give, to me, needed to be treated in the bonus category. I will not count on a guy that's been as injured as that. And it sort of fits on brand that he was, of course, leaving practice or injured once again on Thursday. And we don't know the severity of it, to your point, rightly so. But I don't know how much that aids into it. It probably makes the calculation a little bit easier, as you've alluded to correctly. You got a Hall of Famer. You got two first-year guys, one coming off of surgery in Bryce Love, who hasn't played in the league yet. Gibson, is an enticing young player. A couple veterans in McKissick and Peyton Barber. That's a crowded room. So you become a little bit more expendable if you can't act right.
Rivera was also asked, the juxtaposition that everyone's making now, how do you cut guys so fast? But yet Reuben Foster gets activated for his roster spot, who had his own domestic issues, and you still have Cody Latimer, who's got a gun charge where he allegedly fired a firearm in a room with people that he's dealing with on the commissioner's exempt list. Now, personally, I'll just dismiss the Reuben Foster comparison. I think it's lazy. And I think it's easy to make a zing and snarky comment on Twitter. It also makes no sense. Rivera wasn't here when they signed Reuben Foster. Foster got here and was told, if you're going to stay here, here's all the things you have to do. He has done all those things based on everything that we know. In addition to that, he got hurt. He has rehabbed diligently. Since Rivera got here, he's been a model citizen. So unless you just expect Rivera to cut everyone who's ever been in trouble off the field or had any kind of a domestic issue, I don't really get that comp at all. Oh, by the way, Reuben Foster is no longer dealing with those allegations, as that never ended up being something that he had to go to jail for, as he got exonerated and let off from those charges. But the more interesting comp to me is Cody Latimer, because he was signed by the staff, and he did get in trouble while Rivera was here. And while it's not something to do with women, and it's not after this Washington Post story, he's still on the team. Rivera was asked about that.
Well, the biggest thing is when the Cody Latimer situation came out, there were some things that that still we hadn't known. So what happened was he goes onto the commissioner's exempt list, and so we're now in a position where we're just going to continue to monitor it and see what happens, and we'll go from there with Cody. As I said, and again, understand that we will look at each situation, each set of circumstances individually, and we'll go through our process and make our assessments.
Latimer might benefit from the fact that, unlike running back, which is chock full of decent options, as we just mentioned, wide receivers probably the thinnest spot on this roster, but mm-hmm. I would still bet you a dollar or a lunch or a bottle of soda or whatever you want that he doesn't play for this team. I don't think you can cut him while he's on the commissioner exempt list. My guess is this investigation ongoing, the league's looking into it. I mean, he doesn't mean much to Rivera or this team. If he does stay on the roster, it's going to just be because they need wide receivers and you're about to get signed and I'm about to get signed. But I would bet you a couple bucks that he doesn't see the field for Washington. We'll see.
Yeah, I'm not taking that bet. I would bet the exact same thing happens as you.
Grant and Danny on the Fan. Let's talk to the writer at the Washington Post who's got the details on the Geis allegations that have come out. They are troubling. He'll tell you about them next right here on the Fan.
I'm not taking that bet.
Doesn't know yet.
I would bet the exact same thing happens as you.
Danny on the Fan. In 25 minutes at 2 o'clock, Chad Dukes versus the world comes your way right here on the Fan. We're Grant and Danny. Thanks for listening. Let's get the latest on the biggest story in D.C. sports today, and that is the arrest and the release of Washington football running back Darius Geis, no longer with the team. Justin Juvenile is the justice reporter for the Washington Post, and he joins us now on G&D. Justin, you actually had some details that came out on the allegations that have not been public until you released them, so can you give our listeners the latest on what you found out and how you found out?
Yeah, some charging documents were filed in the case today that lay out the first in-depth look at the charges against Darius Geis, and they're pretty disturbing. In the documents, it says in March, Geis choked his girlfriend until she was unconscious in his Ashburn home. And then when she woke up, she said that Geis was tapping her and also crying at the time. There was another incident earlier this year where Geis allegedly pushed her to the pavement outside his house and then threw her cell phone, which shattered. He also pushed her in the bathroom of his house at one point, and she fell over. She injured her thumbnail, and the thumbnail eventually popped off. and all of these allegations are detailed in Loudoun County Court. And just to be fully fair, Geis has said through his attorney that he denies all the allegations.
So help some little. What's a little confusing about this, Justin, is it's Loudoun County, but Montgomery County is involved as well. I guess that's where the alleged victim resides. Walk me through the logistics there of why multiple municipalities were involved.
Yeah, the incidents all happened in Geis's home, which is in Ashburn. So that's why Loudoun County was investigating it. But the initial reports came from the victim, who lives in Montgomery County. So she initially reported the incidents to Montgomery County police, who then alerted the Loudoun County Sheriff's Office, which began their investigation along with Montgomery County Police. So you have the victim living in one jurisdiction and then the Geis living in a different jurisdiction. That's why you have Montgomery County and Loudoun County both involved.
And these three instances, were they in three separate months, if I'm correct? Can you give us kind of the timeline?
Sorry, I should have been more clear about that. Yeah, the first incident happened in February, the second one in March, and the third one was in April. So these happened over a course of time. And you have, as a result, three charges of assault and battery, one of destruction of property, and then in the choking incident, a charge of strangulation.
When did the team find out any information, and then was there a larger bit of discovery that kind of came Thursday here, Justin? What do we know about that?
I don't have as much insight into what the team knew when. From our reporting, we know that they knew at least by Thursday night. Obviously, Geis was released after they became aware of the charges and they became public. The court documents don't really shed any light on what the team knew. They're solely focused on the criminal case, and they don't really deal with the Washington football team in any particular way.
Justin Juvenal of the Washington Post has the latest based on these court documents, the allegations, the accusations against Darius Geis. And as he pointed out, Geis, through his attorney, has said, for the record, that these allegations are not true. But one of them that came out so troubling that everybody's reading is that at one point he choked this woman until she was unconscious, and she came to with him crying and tapping her. So do we know yet what happens now? Like, I don't understand. Sometimes it feels like cases can be heard quickly. Other times it takes months. Like, where are we at now with Darius Geis? He's obviously not in jail at this moment, so what happens?
Yeah, he got out on bail, a $10,000 bond on Friday. They scheduled his initial court appearance for August 28th. That's when he would likely be arraigned in the case. They'll read him the charges and go over that. There could be additional hearings that are scheduled down the line, but that's the latest of what we have in terms of when he might appear in court. It's likely, given the pandemic, that any kind of court proceeding would be stretched out over normal times, just because everything in the court system right now is moving slower because of the pandemic.
So can you walk me through the one, and again, I hate doing this sort of stuff, but just for clarity's sake, it sounds like one of the incidents, Justin, took place, and then the alleged victim left and didn't find out till later because she had a flight to catch, and there was all this sort of complication therein. Can you go into that one of the three separate incidents?
Yeah, that's the most troubling one. That's the strangulation charge. Basically, the woman claims she told authorities on March 13th that Geis strangled her inside his home. She goes unconscious, and then when she awakens, Geis is tapping her and crying at the same time. She had to catch a flight at DWI, so she said she hurried out of the house. She said she didn't get a chance to look at her injuries until she got to a flyover stop in Chicago. And then she went into the bathroom at the airport and looked at herself and realized that she had some bruising around her neck. She had colored marks, I guess, from this alleged strangulation. She took a photo of the injuries. And in each of these cases, authorities say in the charging documents that she took photographs of the injuries shortly after they occurred. And now when she made that layover in the airport, that's the first time she realized that she had these injuries.
At Jay Juvenal on Twitter for his account and the latest on this story. And you can go check out the details and the journalism being done in the Washington Post Online Now. Justin Juvenile with us on Grant and Danny. Justin, thank you for the time. It's a troubling story. We appreciate you.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you, Justin.
Absolutely. And Danny, for Darius Geis, and his attorney comes out and says that this is not correct, and you know he is going to fight this, obviously, tooth and nail as best he can. It's the fact that you've got three different situations where she's gone to the cops soon thereafter with photos, presumably. And maybe that's something I could have clarified, but to my knowledge, I think each of those times she reported this, it wasn't that it was reported after the fact as three different instances. And you've got this story of him crying and tapping her as she's unconscious, allegedly. Man, just so troubling and awful.
Yeah, it's tough to talk about. So it sounds as if, according to the story here, February you get the incident, quote-unquote, with the thumbnail, the destruction
the
of the cell phone.
Yeah, he shoves her to the ground in the bathroom, supposedly.
Then March is the strangulation flight, and then April it's undisclosed in the court documents. What the injuries were, but apparently there are the photographs there of that as well, and that's kind of something that's all part of this. So there's no specific or specified injuries from the April 17th incident, but you do have three separate times where and the charges reflect that. So man, oh man, is it just again, nothing about this is good.
Grant and Danny on the Fan. We will hit the leftovers. This date in Nats history as well before we get out of here in our final segment next on the Fan. Final furlong of Grant and Danny here on the Fan before we get to the leftovers. Hit all the best of the rest of the topics that we've got for you today, rapid fire. We always start this final segment by going back in time. It's August 10th, 2020. That means we got to find a fun August 10th game in Nats history. So we go back 7 years ago to 2013, the Phillies and the Nationals, an 8-5 win. Jason Wirth, a two-run home run for his 1,000th hit, the 34-year-old at the time, a go-ahead two-run shot for hit number 1,000. He had three hits in the game as he was terrorizing his former team.
31-year-old righty to face Jason Wirth, who sits on the precipice of 1,000 career hits. He had number 999 last inning, one of two tonight against Cliff Lee. The pitch, swinging a high drive to left field, deep toward the corner. Brown going back to the warning track, to the wall. It's gone! Career hit number 1,000 is a go-ahead two-run homer for the former Philly, Jason Wirth. And listen to this crowd. They go bonkers as the Nationals have taken the lead 6-4.
That was part of Jason Wirth's last good season as a Washington National. In fact, he was great that year, GP. How about a .318 average, .398 on base percentage, a .931 OPS, 25 bombs to go with mid-80s runs scored and 80-plus RBIs, a complete player whose defense was not yet a liability. Finished 13th overall in MVP voting, and it would go downhill from there, but fan allegiance never changed. But a nice moment for him, certainly against the team that let him walk away, and he always had fun tormenting his former AL East employer.
The Caps got the shaft today a little bit on the show, unfortunately.
Yeah, they did.
Would have liked to have talked more about their big weekend. They got a win. They are headed to the playoffs Wednesday night. Their postseason starts, and by the way, the road to the Cup. On 106.7, the Fan, driven by LindsayCars.com. Over 1,700 vehicles to choose from, all backed by the Lindsay family name and reputation you know and trust. You'll love it at LindsayLindsayCars.com. But, Danny, that matchup is mouthwatering. Now, we can go through the history in detail tomorrow of Barry Trotz leaving. Now, there was an option. You can make the case that it was a mutual departure. But it seemed like the Caps, who almost fired him, in 2018, the year they won the Stanley Cup, had decided internally that Todd Reirden was going to be the guy. Now, there is video of him, I think it was Torch that he was talking to after the Columbus series, where he pretty clearly is seen saying, like, I'm out, I'm done, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But we knew. You know, we have this revisionist history after they won the Cup, and everyone now loves Trotz, but before that, he hadn't won, and he can't get over the hump of the second round. And there were all these stories about players not enjoying playing for him as much and all these things. And that all changed after he won the Stanley Cup. But I've always viewed this as someone who was kind of watching this closely. that the decision had been made. They were going to go with Reardon, who they viewed as their defensive mastermind anyway. Well, I say all that to tell you that starting on Wednesday night, the Caps in a playoff series, best of seven against the Islanders, against Barry Trotz and goalie coach Mitch Korn and a bunch of the assistants he brought from Washington to New York, this is going to be amazing television. And in this case, for us, radio here on the Fan and our sister stations for this Stanley Cup postseason round against a bunch of familiar faces. You know who's in net for them? Semyon Varlamov, by the way. It's going to be a blast.
Yeah, it doesn't feel real because they sort of just started getting back together and these games have felt like exhibition-y, but the real playoffs start at 3 p.m. on Wednesday. How odd is that to say, by the way? But yeah, here we go. The matchup is marquee and must watch, especially if you care about either one of these franchises. And the Caps, you know, since the departure of Barry Trotz, I mean, you got a sample of almost a couple years, and it's now seems, and at the time we said, hey, maybe we should question this a little bit, but they won a Stanley Cup, so the feelings were so good, and those feelings still are good, but the bigger sample with Reardon, you know, the more data we certainly have here, and this is a chance for Barry Trotz to remind his former employer, hey, you guys did me wrong here. Chance for Todd Reardon to say, no, you all made the right call. Last year we kind of forgave. They were tired at the end of the season, just sort of looked a step slow against a frisky Carolina Hurricanes team that they, you know, had a lead in game seven, still couldn't find a way to get it done. But yeah, this is big. This is really, really big, man. And I feel
you
like
can
there's
easily
not
make the
hyper-attention.
The Canes lost without Oshie and Kempney in the first round last year.
Yeah.
And now with the pandemic, like if you're Reardon and 2 years in, you get bounced in the first round if you lose to the Islanders. There's a lot of excuses and explanations and
sure,
reasons.
That's true.
And it doesn't mean you're a bad hockey coach. But bottom line is, and I'll say this, that fans are going to feel this way because I'm going to feel this way too. If you get beat by Trotz, who will have the Islanders going further than the Capitals, and in 2 years since he left, the Islanders will have gotten past the first round, and in neither of those years have the Capitals been able to do that, it's just not going to look or feel right, period, regardless of what led up to it. So if you're Reardon, you really need your boys to play well and respond and get you a series win here against Trotz's Isles. Tonight, 7:10, first pitch, Citi Field in Flushing, New York. The Mets hosting the Nationals, believe it or not, in Game 12. Their first road game, Danny. Patrick Corbin, the lefty, against fellow southpaw Steven Matz, who the Nats roughed up last time he went through the rotation. They've always hit him pretty well, so hopefully that trend continues today. Starlin Castro's owned him in his career, hitting .320 and 25 career at-bats. Juan Soto hits .462 off of him. Asdrubal Cabrera's hitting .500 off of him in a few at-bats. Josh Harrison's 5-for-10 with 2 homers off of him in his career. So hopefully they can stay hot against Steven Matz, but they need a win after now struggling through the weekend against the Baltimore Orioles, losers of 3.5 in a row because they didn't get to finish yesterday's game, which they're trailing.
They lost 3 2/3, I guess. Yeah, they got a hit, and they need to get going. This offense has to start pulling its weight and bail them out of, put them over the top in a couple of these close games. But they need Strasburg to be healthy. Scherzer's supposed to go tomorrow, but they need a nice start from Patrick Corbin in Flushing.
Wiz still looking for their first win in the bubble. Oh, by the way, they've fallen to 0-6. And easy, right? They got the Bucks coming up next, I believe. So they should be able to win that one. That'll be a 9 o'clock tip. Nothing wrong there. That's an easy game.
Just stop Giannis, as everybody has done all year long.
Exactly. I won't bother asking Danny what he's going to do tonight because he doesn't know yet, and it just makes for a boring exchange to end our show on a low note. With that being said, for Thommy, Darris, Danny, Grant saying so long and thanks. To Owen. And,
they got the team, right, Bucks?
I believe. So
they should be able to be a simple. And if nothing,
that's an easy game.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with 3 rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.